Taped from New Jersey, it's the SNL Nerds, the show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out about Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
And I'm your co-host, John Trumbull. And Darren, I am so excited. We got a very special guest with us today.
Oh, we do.
I think it's safe to say a comedy legend. This is a man who came out of Second City. He has written for Conan O'Brien since the Late Show days, onto The Tonight Show, onto Conan. And then, because that wasn't enough legendary stuff for him, he moved on and was writing for all 11 years of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Brian Stack.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you for that incredibly kind introduction. I really appreciate it. And thanks for having me on.
And we should say, we just looked him up on the Television Academy website. 23 nominations, this guy.
Whoa.
And one in 2007, which I think just shows how competitive the late night writing field is.
It was kind of funny, too. Thank you for mentioning that. It's funny, the 1 year we won, I wasn't there at the Emmys.
Really?
Yeah, because we always lost. So, that particular year, we were going to have to work the next day. So we were like, we'd have to catch the red eye flight. And we're like, we always lost. It was always fun to be there. And it was an honor to be nominated. I know that's a cliche, but it was. But right. The 1 year we won, I was doing the ASCAD improv show at UCB when we found out that we won. Because I kind of forgot that. Because every year we just lost, but we were always happy.
Yeah,
to be nominated. But that was a nice little souvenir from all the late night years that I had there. And that was a nice surprise.
Yeah. Oh, well, is it fun to go to an Emmy ceremony or like a Writers Guild award ceremony, even if you don't end up winning? I mean, what is that experience like?
It is fun. Like I wrote for a few too. So that was an even more interesting experience because Conan hosted the Emmys twice and Stephen hosted it once. And that was fun to kind of see behind the scenes and how they do stand-ins for the celebrity speeches. And it's a very weird, kind of surreal thing to be back behind the scenes there. But it's fun. You know, you get to see some friends in LA that you might not have seen in a while, or and just kind of, you know, just to have the experience of seeing like a few people you might really admire, like from across the room, like, oh my God, that's, you know, just so, someone you a writer or actor that you really admire. That's always a fun little bonus.
Yeah. I mean, you must've met like so many different celebrities over the course of your years with Conan and Colbert. I mean, do you ever, are you always starstruck? Do you still get starstruck or do you get blasé about it almost? Because, I mean, you just have to deal with them as people.
I still do get starstruck. But what's kind of funny is I'm still starstruck the most by people who meant a lot to me when I was coming up, when I was a kid. You know, like Conan, for example, said once the most starstruck he ever was when he interviewed Peter Falk, because Peter Falk played Columbo and Columbo was the biggest show when he was a kid. So there's something about those people you grow up with. Like whenever I see like the SCTV people, like Andrea Martin or Martin Short or Eugene Levy or Steve Martin, you know, these people that I mean, Steve Martin, everybody gets blown away by, but to see these people in the hallway was very surreal because they're people that I admired so much during my formative years when I was coming up and getting interested in comedy. And, I still get really struck by the fact that sometimes you can't believe some of the people are real people. Like in the last Colbert show when Paul McCartney was standing there.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, he's a real person who takes up space and is like just standing there. That was very surreal.
I just rewatched the last Colbert to, you know, kind of refresh my memory. Were you the Pope in that?
I was. I was gonna, my original, that was kind of a last second pitch. From that morning, I joke that what if we said the Pope was supposed to be on, but he wouldn't come out of his dressing room because they had the wrong snacks.
Right.
And I was picturing like a closed door with like you hear him trashing his dressing room inside. And Stephen said, why don't we make it play up the Chicago angle and just have Brian do like a Chicago voice and throw a hot dog at the screen. So that was Stephen's addition to that.
Nice. But,
yeah, that was just kind of doing a cartoony version of my Chicago roots there.
Yeah, because I was watching it and I was like, that sounds kind of like Brian to me. I think that's Brian. I'm not 100% positive.
But... Oh, thanks for noticing. Yeah, that was, yeah, I wasn't expecting to do that. That was very last minute.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So, I mean, you touched on the fact that like Steve Martin was kind of one of your comedy heroes grow up. Like who else was, did you really look up to? Like, how did you get into the world of comedy in the first place and improv and writing comedy?
Well, when I was coming up, I was a huge comedy fan, but it never occurred to me that I could do it myself. It seemed like showbiz people came from outer space or something, you know, because growing up in Chicago, I didn't know anybody in show business or that worked in the television or film industry. So, and I was a really shy kid, you know, I kind of was quiet and kind of mumbled to myself. And when I was a kid, it never occurred to me that entertainers could be introverted. Like I thought all entertainers were extroverts by nature. They'd have to be. And I've learned over the years that I'd say at least half, maybe more of the entertainers I've come across tend to be introverted people, kind of quiet. Mm-hmm. Even Steve Martin, who I was lucky enough to say a quick thank you once in the hall to, there's nothing wacky about him or crazy. Like he's very gracious and almost like a nice professor, you know? Mm-hmm. Steven, you know, is admittedly kind of an introvert himself, even though there's such a contradiction there that it's somebody that would go out in front of millions of people, but sometimes a lot of entertainers are less comfortable at a cocktail party than they are hosting the Emmys.
100%. Yeah.
I get that.
I understand. I got a follow from, I think the voiceover actress Tara Strong once, where I said like, oh, sure, doing stand-up comedy is brave and all, but have you ever tried having an unscripted conversation with someone in the real world? And she like liked that and followed me after that. And I was like, oh, well, she relates. Okay.
That's a fantastic line. Yeah, that's so relatable for me too. Yeah, I mean, I got interested in comedy like early SNL, SCTV, Monty Python, Steve Martin, Richard Pryor. Mm-hmm. And a lot of old movies that I grew up with that I got turned on to through my parents and my grandparents, like the old screwball comedies, like with William Powell and Carol Lombard and, you know, all those movies like Bringing Up Baby and The Awful Truth and the old Cary Grant movies and stuff like that. And also Billy Wilder movies like The Apartment but shows I watched like Cheers and Bob Newhart Show and Mary Tyler Moore Show that we used to watch as a family. And the Carol Burnett Show was huge for us too in terms of, I thought that looked like the most fun because they got to play a bunch of different characters, you know, like they did on Monty Python and SCTV. And like my early favorite SNL performers were always the chameleons, like Dan Aykroyd and, you know, Lorraine Newman and Gilda Radner, like who would just inhabit these characters the way later people like Kristen Wiig and Bill Hader would, you know. Those are the ones I tended to zone in on most, even though I love Belushi and I love Bill Murray. I was especially drawn to the character chameleons, you know?
I
fell into improv when I was in college. A friend of mine, Mick Napier, who later directed at Second City, had an improv group that I didn't have the guts to audition for, but I used to go see them and think, oh, that looks so fun. I wish I had the guts to try it. And then he told me about Improv Olympic, which is now called IO in Chicago. And I took classes there right after college and fell in love with it instantly and wish I'd tried it sooner. And then when I got up to University of Wisconsin, Madison for grad school, there was this little theater there called the Arc Theater where I did my first performing in front of people ever. And the late great Chris Farley was actually in my first group there. And he was from Madison. So it was just pure luck that we ended up in the same group, but it was so obvious even in that early stage that he was really special. And we were all kind of looking at each other like, is it just me or is this guy funnier than people in movies? And, you know, everybody kind of thought that even if you'd go out to bars with him, he would make complete strangers laugh so hard that they'd be falling off their stools. So it was really obvious that he was special. And by the time I got back to Chicago, he was already kind of on a lightning track in Chicago. And Del Close put him in the Second City cast almost immediately. And he totally deserved to be. And then he was on SNL within a couple years of going to Chicago. And I went to his first SNL show, actually, which was incredibly exciting, the fall of 1990. And Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm getting way ahead of.
No, it's fine. It's was Farley like a guy who was on all the time in your experience? Because you said he would like make strangers laugh at bars and stuff like that.
Well, he would be really. He was kind of a shy, insecure guy. As you can see, when you watch the Chris Farley show, as all the other old, anyone who knows him personally would say, that was pretty much him. Like mm-hmm. that the kind of insecure guy who's smacking himself in the head thinking he said something stupid. And I think he, another guy who is very comfortable performing, but kind of a shy, you know, insecure, sweet guy, you know, off stage. Who a lot of times, like most comedians I know, me included, struggle with self-esteem issues. And like, it's a lot of what drives us into comedy in the first place. Where,
yeah.
But Chris was, you know, so blessed with a natural gift that he was one of those guys that could do the same thing multiple times and it would always be funny. Like, we'd be walking down the street in Madison and an attractive woman would walk by and he'd start doing push-ups, go 198, 199. And it was funny every time because he committed to it so hard, you know? Mm-hmm. And so he was always, it was no surprise to anyone who saw him in Madison or Chicago that he seemed destined to go on to bigger things. And we were so happy for him when he did. And I wish, you know, like everyone else, I wish he were still with us because he had so many things that he could do that he didn't get a chance to show everyone in films. Like he could play really subtle, very subtle character bits that had nothing to do with his physicality. You know, he was really a wonderful natural actor.
Yeah. It would have been really interesting to see what he evolved into over time. Yeah.
Yeah, he was supposed to play Fatty Arbuckle, you know, mm-hmm. in a David Mamet film. I don't know if they're ever going to make that, but you probably heard he was supposed to be, he was the original voice of Shrek.
Yeah.
I think.
Mike Myers. Yeah.
Yeah, Mike Myers did a great job at that, but Farley's vulnerability and his combination of strength and vulnerability, it made it no surprise that they thought of him for that role.
Yeah, you know, originally, yeah, I can see that.
He has so much, there's so much of that kind of sensitive big guy feel to him, you know, that would have come through in that character.
Yeah. Did you have a moment like early on in your career where you were like, oh, I could make a career out of this doing comedy? Or was it just like a hobby that evolved into a career? How did that evolve for you?
It kind of evolved. Like when I first tried it, I was just hoping I wouldn't embarrass myself, you know, like when I started doing improv. And luckily, early on in Madison, I was having a lot of fun doing it. So I knew I wanted to keep doing it, but I thought it would just be on an amateur level. And once some of my friends started doing stuff, like, and moving up a little bit in the comedy world and maybe earning even a little bit of money doing it, I started to dare to dream a little bit that I might be able to do it. And to be honest, the top of the mountain for me in Chicago was just to work at Second City. That was my big dream. And mm-hmm. I didn't think I was going to get to do that. And because I would get so self-conscious in my auditions at Second City because I wanted it so bad. And but luckily they came to see a group that we were all in called Jazz Freddy, which included a couple future SNL people like Dave Koechner and Rachel Dratch. They were in that group. And my wife, Miriam Tolan, was in the group. And Kevin mm-hmm. Dorff, who wrote with me at Conan. And, you know, it was a really, really fun. And Pat Finn, who is Farley's best friend at Marquette, who sadly passed away this year, who is just one of the best guys in the world. Everyone loved Pat. And he was so, so funny. You could see him in some of the Farley documentaries and stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a wonderful group. But they came to see that group and hired several of us from coming to see that. And I'm so glad I didn't know they were in the audience because I was just having fun. And I felt bad just like in my auditions.
And like, from what I understand, when you started writing for Conan, it was originally just like a temp position. You were like, I guess a fill-in writer for someone else. And then it turned into 18 years, right?
Yeah, it was kind of crazy. Tommy Blacha, who's a brilliantly funny guy, who had come out of Chicago and was a good friend of Andy Richter's. Tommy's one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life. But Tommy had broken his leg really badly. And in the days before Zoom, you know, he couldn't work from home, you know, so he was kind of out of commission for a couple months. And they said, well, why don't we bring someone out to fill in? And then a couple of the guys like Andy Richter and Brian McCann and Tommy and Greg Cohen, you know, who I knew from Chicago, they recommended that I send in a packet just to be considered for the temporary fill-in position. And luckily they, John Groff, who was our head writer at the time, and Conan, who didn't know me at all, neither of them knew me, they liked it enough, luckily, to bring me out for 13 weeks. And then thankfully the stuff I was doing during those first 13 weeks, they liked enough to keep me on, and it ended up being 18 years, which is really crazy. And I'll always be so grateful to Amy Poehler too, because we knew Amy from Chicago. Mm-hmm. And we loved her, like everyone loves her, and she can do anything, obviously. And she was in the first sketch I wrote at Conan, the first character sketch, which was Andy's little sister, which was where she played a little girl with pigtails and braces who was had a big crush on Conan and becomes mm-hmm. homicidally enraged when he politely mm-hmm. rejects her. And yeah. Her performance was so brilliant that she took a basic idea that I had that was just, I was hoping it would work. And I the script was fine, but her performance kicked it up to such a memorable sketch. And we ended up doing several of them. And so I'll always be grateful to her, because no one told me this, but I think that's probably one of the reasons I was kept on past that for 13 weeks, because that sketch went over so well. And luckily I was getting some other stuff on too, but I think that really helped. So I'll always be grateful to Amy.
Yeah.
Now the Andy's little sister, I remember that being a pretty amazing sketch. I remember that there was that one, like I think they show it reruns, where like Amy Poehler like ran, like she was always in the audience, and at one point she like ran down the aisle and like launched herself onto Richter, like, and he just fell over.
Like, that was amazing. And Amy ad-libbed the line she said right before she ran down, which was, you know what? It's Judgment Day, bitch. And that was pure Amy. So I can't take credit for that. And she hit him. Conan described it when he was interviewing her on his podcast. He described it as like, she hit him like, she jumped, leapt at him like a leopard, you know, like it was just, and she hit him on a full run. And I was talking to Andy and he said he actually accidentally got a perfect chiropractic adjustment when he hit the ground. Like he goes, oh, nice.
I don't have to go to the doctor this week. Nice.
Exactly. But that was, those were really, really fun times. And she was always a delight. You know, she can do anything, obviously.
And I was reading in like the early years for that, at least she wasn't relying on cue cards. She was memorizing those entire sketches.
That was totally my fault. And I'm so embarrassed about it. I was so new and dumb that I didn't know that the audience doesn't really look at the cards much. They're looking more at the monitors or watching what's going on. But I thought if they see the jokes, they're going to know everything that's coming. So I said, Amy, would you mind just like memorize, which is an outrageous thing to ask her to do. And she just didn't even blink. She's like, no problem. And so, which made her performance even more amazing to me, because she had to memorize things, and those scripts get changed a lot. Like during rehearsal, things get cut, and she nailed it word for word. But I'm so embarrassed looking back that I didn't let her have cue cards. It would have taken so much pressure off of her, but she, she's such an incredible genius performer that it didn't even matter. But that was a ridiculous thing to ask her to do.
So it wasn't like all the way through doing that bit. It was just like maybe the first one or two.
I think so. I think I realized that how insane that was. And someone told me, Brian, what are you doing? You know, we use cards for everything. Conan has cards. It's, you know, it's like SNL does. It'd be like asking the SNL host to not use cue cards.
We actually interviewed Wally Fairstein, the cue card guy for SNL and currently Late Night with Seth Meyers a few years back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, really, really nice guy.
Those guys were the best at our show, like Steve King, who did a lot of the cards for SNL, and Rich Berm and those guys. They I was amazed that they all learned the same handwriting style. Mm. Like, so that all the cards always look the same. It's like you'd think it would be John's handwriting and Darren's handwriting, you know, that would look a little different. You'd be able to tell. but they right. learn a particular kind of printing so that it always looks the same.
Wow.
And that's why to this day, if I see a card from SNL or something, it looks just like a card from Conan, because they're just, it's the exact same printing style.
Yeah, it's like, it must be almost like learning calligraphy or something.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a real craft and skill.
So how did it come about that you ended up doing characters on camera at Conan? Because you had a large number of characters. You had Artie Kendall, the singing ghost, Hannigan, the traveling salesman. There was, I don't think you did this more than once, but it's a favorite of mine, so I'm going to mention it. The Men Without Hats channel.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That was my wife, Miriam's in that, by the way. She's the one who asked me for a divorce.
Oh, wonderful.
Oh, nice. That's her.
Yeah, that's her.
And knowing that's your real life wife makes that even better.
Yeah, she just looks at me with total contempt there, which I've probably given her lots of reasons to do that. Thank you for remembering that bit. That was a fun, silly one-off bit. But the character, it sort of grew gradually. Like at first, they would be like, hey, Brian, can you do like a cowboy voice? So like for one of the Clutch Cargo things with the lips, they had me be the Marlboro man. But, you know, Robert Smigel obviously did most of the voices for Clutches. But gradually over the years, I would start doing a little more of those. Like I did Martha Stewart a little bit, and I did a few other people. But Robert was obviously the main Clutch guy. And but I started gradually... Like maybe if I'd start doing a bit in the office, I would do like a voice or something, and they'd be like, hey, Brian, we could have you try something like that. Or one of the first characters I did was a bit that had gotten cut from one of our Second City shows, just called Bath Time Bob, the hygiene cowboy. Mm-hmm. And he was a cowboy who just showed up in people's bathrooms singing about how it's important to scrub yourself clean. But he's clearly... off, you know, and disturbed.
So he's not in the bathtub. He's outside the bathtub instructing the people.
He came in like a kid's cowboy, you know, singing about how important it is to scrub yourself clean. But he bursts into people's bathrooms and he's clearly, you know, deranged. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the first things. And then gradually over the years, I started doing stuff. And a lot of times when I wrote sketches, I would think, okay, who's the best person to play this? And I would write something and I'd be like, oh, McCann's the perfect person for this, or Jack McBrayer's perfect for this, or Amy's mm-hmm. perfect for this. And so I was writing for a lot of our friends. Like I would write a lot of sketches for, like I remember Paul Appel, one of the SNL writers, came in and played a mom in a sketch. So it was always fun to cast people that I knew and loved from either from the SNL writers or from UCB. And a lot of the UCB people like Ian Roberts and Matt Besser and Matt Walsh would come in and play characters for us. But every mm-hmm. now and then I'd be like, somebody would say, I think, Brian, you should do this. Like McCann suggested I play Frankenstein, probably because I don't bend my knees much and I just kind of walk like that anyway. And I think my natural goofy personality made Frankenstein more like a kid who just wants to please, you know, almost like showing his parents this report card, like, like that. And I think that came from my own natural dorkiness. And then... And then the crooner ghost happened. I just started to realize, the Rock Post Center has been here since like 1930. So there were old radio singers there. And I remember hearing that Bing Crosby had this dark side that you never saw on screen. Mm-hmm. Like I started wondering, like, what if there was a guy from that time that had views that even in his own time weren't acceptable? he's basically a monster. And I always tried to make it clear that he got murdered. You know?
Yeah. Like on the day we're recording this, like earlier this afternoon, you posted a compilation of this on your Blue Sky profile. And it was fun to see how the character evolved. And yeah, he was just, and yeah, you gradually revealed that he was murdered. He was like thrown down a well by some outraged women.
So there was one, I think he was beheaded by the League of Women Voters and like, and thrown down a well. And, he probably got murdered multiple ways, but, it was very, that was one that just kind of, I would have varied the melody more of the songs if I knew I was going to do more than one of them, you know, but, and Hannigan, the traveling salesman, originally Andrew Weinberg and Michael Komen, who I love those guys, wonderful writers and great guys. They suggested I play a traveling salesman, kind of an old timey, because they would hear me do that mm-hmm. William Powell voice that I learned from all those old movies. And they said, what if Brian plays an old-timey salesman? And then we wrote the sketches together, and it got more fleshed out, and the jokes got crazier and crazier. And the Interrupter, which was another recurring character I did originally, Michael Coman suggested that just as a joke on the fact that so many characters interrupt Conan in the middle of the show. Like there'll be suddenly a beekeeper running in, you know, going, ah, bees, you know, and so Conan joked at rehearsal once, how are you going to interrupt me today? Like, who's going to interrupt me? And Michael said, what if we had a character whose sole purpose is to interrupt the show? And then the more Michael and I wrote those sketches, the more fleshed out he got. And he had this horrible life. He had 7 different types of hepatitis and lived in a dumpster behind the Port Authority bus terminal and everything. But originally he was just supposed to be interrupting the show. And then he got weirder and weirder and darker and darker. And it was fun to come back and do that for Conan when he did the Mark Twain prize, when he got the Mark Twain prize.
Yes.
It was so incredibly sweet. Nikki Glaser asked me to come and interrupt her speech as the Interrupter. So that was such, I was so nervous, and I kept hoping it would get, to be honest, I kept hoping it would get cut. Because I was like, well, I don't want to do this in front of so many people I admire, and I don't want to ruin Conan's night and everything. But it ended up being really, really fun. So I'm so grateful to Nikki for asking me to do that, because she loves Conan as much as anyone ever has, I think.
Yeah. And
that was, she's so sweet about saying how much Conan helped shape her own sense of humor and what she loves to do. And I often forget, like, oh yeah, she's like 20 years younger than me. So she has like, she was like in college when we were doing a lot of our bits. And the way I watched Letterman, you know, and watched Chris Elliott. Chris Elliott was like one of my big heroes, and he helped shape my idea of what was possible and how you could just do really fun, silly bits if you just commit to them.
Yeah, I mean, because he did a lot of absurd characters on the Letterman show too, like the guy who lived under the stairs. And
right.
I mean, one time he just came on and he did a straight parody of William Shatner at the Saturn Awards singing Rocket Man.
Yeah.
And that was the bit. He hardly even put much of a spin on it. It was because the original Shatner bit was so weird.
I know. And he would come out as Marlon Brando and just like wearing a muumuu or something. And I just love Chris Elliott so much. And I was lucky enough to do one little thing with him on Andrew Weinberg and Michael Coman, who I mentioned earlier. They created a show called Eagle Heart because they loved Chris Elliott so much. And Chris Elliott was the star of that. And they had me come in to do one guest bit. And it was such a thrill to meet him because he's one of my heroes, like the SCTV people were. And he couldn't have been nicer. And that was really nice. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that I didn't think he would be, but you know, you're always a little afraid when you meet your heroes that they're going to disappoint you. And he couldn't have been nicer.
Just to backtrack to the Mark Twain Award a bit. Did Conan know that you were going to come on as the Interrupter during Nikki Glaser's bit?
He didn't. And they wanted to make it a surprise. And I was trying not to even have him know I was there. But I ran into him in the hotel lobby and he's like, Brian. But Stephen Colbert was doing a bit in the show. So I was like, oh, maybe he just thinks I'm here to help with Stephen's bit. Cause we kicked around some ideas for that too. And so he knew I was in town, but he didn't know why I was there exactly.
Oh,
but,
okay.
Maybe he guessed, but he seemed, he certainly rolled with it. Like he wasn't expecting it. And, I don't think he knew what we were going to do exactly.
Fantastic. Well, I have a quick question. So, I mean, we've talked about a lot of the characters you've done on Conan. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't get into the lore of the Slipknots. Something I kind of went back and watched before this, and you know, and if you could talk about that, how did that come about, and how did the Slipknot concert thing happen? Where you actually opened for them at the Continental Airlines Arena out here in Jersey?
It was insane. The original creation of it was purely out of desperation and sleep deprivation. We didn't have a mid show sketch for the next day, and it was like midnight, and we're sitting in Mike Sweeney's office. Our head writer, and it was me, John Glazer, and Andy Blitz, and we were just like, oh, what should we do? And we looked on the calendar, like, who's on the show tomorrow? And the band Slipknot was on. Mm-hmm. And we were just going, what if there's accidentally a comedy group who's booked the same night because there's a mistake and they're the Slip Nuts? And then we're like, well, what do they do? And it's like, well, I guess they slip on nuts. And then the little song came out of it, and it was just such a nothing idea. But we thought, all right, well, I guess we could try that tomorrow, and we need something. Mm-hmm. So we did it, and it was certainly not something we ever expected to do more than once. And
right.
It turned out to be really fun, and it's very gratifying when, like, comedy friends of ours over the years will mention how much they enjoyed it. And because it's so stupid, and stupid is often like my favorite adjective when I hear like comedy bits described, like Conan and Stephen, whenever they'd say, that's so dumb, that's usually the best stuff. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or it's usually our favorite stuff because it's so dumb in a fun way. And Conan loves smart, dumb comedy. Like there's some intelligence to the dumbness. And so that was kind of an accident when that came up. A lot of our favorite bits were accidents. Bulletproof Legs. I don't know if you ever saw that, but
I love Bulletproof Legs so much.
Well, thanks so much. That was another one that came up purely by accident. I pretended to shoot Brian McCann in the leg sitting next to him before a writer's meeting. And he started singing, he had bulletproof legs. And so I shot him in the chest and he fell over dead. And we're like, we could do that as a new character, I guess.
It's so wonderfully stupid. And I love that you just kept going back and back and back to it.
Another one that we were like, I guess we could try that, you know? And that was, I think, the joy of that show, the late night show particularly, where it felt like you were kind of up in an attic and no one's paying attention. So why not just try stuff? And a lot of times we would forget that anyone was going to see it except for the people in Studio 6A. And I think that was a healthy attitude to have. I think it almost felt like we were back in Chicago just doing it in a little theater, because it was about the size of an improv theater.
Yeah.
Studio 6A. So, but the Slipknot show, they ended up pitching it to have us go open for them. And that was very surreal to run on stage in an arena show. I'd been to arena shows, but I'd never been on stage at one. And the audience reacted just like we hoped they would, with a mixture of confusion and rage. And they were like throwing pups at us. And they, it was funny, right before we went out there, the stage manager goes, hey guys, be careful out there. These fans like to throw batteries at the bands they like. So we're like, oh boy. And Andy Blitz joked that we should have run out for an encore, and I kind of wish we had. But I got to say, the band, we didn't really know what the band thought of the bit, because we you know, maybe the publicist was just letting us do it. But we found out years later that Glazer sent me an interview where the lead singer had said how much they re-enjoyed it. And that really made me happy, because I'm not even a heavy metal guy, and I loved watching that band perform. They were such an amazing spectacle, and it was kind of a mix of punk and thrash and metal. So it had a punk energy to it. And I remember when they played the Heretic anthem on Conan, I was just like, this is great. These guys are, and I wasn't a big heavy metal guy, but I thought they were awesome. And they put on an amazing show that night. One of the funny little details too is Max Weinberg, you know, the head of the Conan's band, was there that night with his son, Jay, who is a big Slipknot fan. Mm-hmm. Years later, Jay became the drummer for Slipknot, which is a little detail, but
That's cool.
That's wild.
Yeah. He was just a teenage fan at the time, but he ended up drumming for them.
Wow. But was there any point during the Slipknot show where you were like fearing for your safety with like whether them throwing batteries at you or just being so enraged that this comedy bit was happening?
Just before we went on, we weren't sure what would happen, but it was so fast and so surreal that it was kind of a blur. So we ran out there, we did our stupid song, and then we ran off, and the audience was so stunned and like confused. And like, you can see in the clips, they're just like, what the hell is this? Mm-hmm. And so we were off before we could kind of get murdered, but that was kind of good. But it was really, and then we stayed and watched a bunch of the show, and it was so fun. They just tore the roof off the place with their energy. Mm-hmm. They must lose 10 pounds a show.
Now, like, okay, you were mentioning the late nights writing for Conan before, and you're doing like remotes, like the Slipknot bit. Is there such a thing as a typical day when you're writing for a late night show? I mean, because it's not really a 9-to-5 type of job, it seems.
No,
like.
It oddly enough, at Colbert, it was more regular hours, like in terms of like we'd get in around 8 a.m. because you have to get on the, because it's much more based on the new day's headlines, mm-hmm. you know, and it's more topical.
Yeah.
But we would usually, we could leave sometimes during the taping, which would start around 5:30 or 6. So unless we had a bit that we had to do in the show. So it was more regular hours. At Conan, we got in a little later, like we'd get in around 10:30 or 11 a.m., but we would often be there till midnight or later, especially in the early days. It was more like the way I think because Conan and Robert Smigel had come out of the SNL system,
they
were kind of more used to the working at night kind of mentality. And since it was my first job, Conan was my first job, that was what I just thought was normal, and that it just seemed entirely, it was all I knew. So, and as crazy as it was, as the hours were, it felt very normal to me. Like it was like, oh, this is just what we do, you know?
Yeah.
We would, and it was such a fun bunch of people and such a crazy environment in a fun way that the time would kind of fly by, even though there were long days, because people were just, you know, we were laughing so much just with stupid office bits and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like bulletproof legs, or McCann put a FedEx box on his head once and started blessing us like the Pope.
Right.
And we're like,
FedEx Pope.
Yeah. It turned into the FedEx Pope purely by accident, because another thing that happened right before a writer's meeting that wasn't supposed to be a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times our favorite stuff comes up that way by purely by accident.
I mean, you've got to be surprised at the stuff that sometimes sticks or repeats, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, and there's probably the opposite too, where you thought, oh, this is a surefire recurring character, and then it just doesn't go over for whatever reason.
Absolutely. We, like Tommy and I did a bit, a sketch called Destructo, where Tommy was this alien who'd been sent from another galaxy just to destroy Conan O'Brien. That was his sole purpose. And he had this really long finger that was supposed to just press this one button that's supposed to kill Conan. But he keeps getting interrupted by mundane things like, his landlord wants a rent check and his girlfriend wants him to drive her son to karate class. And he's like, I'll be right with you. And he goes, prepare for your destruction, O'Brien. And like he keeps, and we, it was really, I remember at rehearsal, our director, Liz Planka, God bless her, who had a wonderful, wonderful sense of humor. She goes, oh, you guys will be doing a lot of these. Mm-hmm. And the audience was just kind of confused by the bit. It went okay, but it was like, that was one where I was like, it felt like it might be a recurring bit, but mm-hmm. It reminds me of just the fact that you never know till the audience tells you.
Yeah.
And a lot of times our favorite stuff would, you'll just kind of die on the vine there. But then when they did go for something that we really liked, it was a wonderful, that was what you always hope for, obviously.
Would there ever be like a bit that maybe didn't go over great with the audience, but Conan or Steven would be like, I don't care. We should do this again anyway. The audience was wrong.
Well, it was never so much that we thought they were wrong. It's just there were times where, sometimes Conan loved to just try things, and Steven too. They liked to try mm-hmm. things that they liked and see. And there were times where we could get laughs on the fact that it didn't get a response too. Like Glazer did
Freaking Joe.
What's that?
Shrieking Joe. You brought him back recently.
Shrieking Joe is a funny case where it was when Kid Rock and Ted Nugent were talking about maybe running for Senate.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the other writers, Jay Katzier, pitched me as a kind of a cross between the two. And he was supposed to be super obnoxious, but we underestimated how off-putting he would be to the audience, because he was supposed to be off-putting. Mm-hmm. But we're like, oh, yeah, they're going to change the channel if he's really, really gross and obnoxious. And there's a reason our audience doesn't like Kid Rock and Ted. So, but Steven really liked it. And we laughed out loud when we saw the ratings, because you could see nowadays you see minute by minute ratings. And
right.
They framed the ratings thing for me when before the Last Week of Joe thing, just to show out, it literally made everyone in America change shit, which was hilarious. And so
I love that.
I laughed out loud when I saw it because we really enjoyed it, and we enjoyed doing it. I know he's gross and he's awful, but that was kind of the point,
right?
And then Carly Mosley, the wonderful Carly Mosley, who I work with at Colbert, one of our hilarious writers, pitched having him come back with his daughter, and she played the daughter. And,
right.
So I certainly didn't expect to have him come back again. but yeah, a lot of times, like, Glazer did a character called Reverend Otis K. Dribbles once, mm-hmm. which is just a guy with a red hound dog mask and priest robes bouncing a basketball to Sweet Georgia Brown. And I think the joke was that we don't always get the best guests. And when big guests cancel, sometimes we have to fall back on our backup guests. And tonight, please welcome the Reverend Otis K. Dribbles. And it was just this insane, you know, guy just bouncing a basketball. And I was in tears laughing at Reverend Otis K. Dribbles. But the audience gave no response at all. They were just totally confused. But when it cuts back to Conan, he goes, "There is no more. That's it." And that got such a big laugh that it stayed in the show. Otherwise, it probably would have been cut. But I can't tell you how often over the years people, like, there'll be like a young comedy writer from some other show that'll say, "You guys did this weird thing with a red mask, a hound dog mask. It was like a mm-hmm. reverend thing." And a lot of times it's one of those bits that they just found entertaining. Or I think a lot of times, as you guys know, you know, a lot of times the bits you respond to most aren't for everybody. They're just almost like bits that other comedy writers love. And we always hope everyone will enjoy it, but there are some bits that are, I think, comedy writers enjoy more than the average.
You're playing to the back of the room. Yeah.
Exactly.
And like, I remember at one point Conan, I can't remember if this was on the late night show or in the later shows, he actually made a recurring bit of like, characters will never have back, or guests will never have back again.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like just a parade of characters. And some of those characters sticked, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Like that was a really fun bit because there could always be there's obviously some horrible reason why they wouldn't be back. And like, I remember once Matt Walsh played a guy who is an animal expert, but he was mm-hmm. allergic to his own animals. So his neck started swelling up, and they did it with like a prosthetic thing. So he's like, his throat's closing up and he can't breathe, but he's showing these animals that he's terribly allergic to. but he's dying like while he's showing the animals. So that was a very fun bit. Cause you could think of just like, there was a guy who was had all these thousands of Smurf dolls. And he comes out, and that was why he's there, you know, to show off his Smurf collection. And he goes, I don't want to talk about the Smurfs, though, okay? it was not going to have him back. So that was always a very fun bit. And it was such a fun place to work, because you could just throw up a lot of stuff just completely died. And we had some complete failures, but it was fun to take a swing and try stuff. And Conan was mm-hmm. always up for doing that.
And of course you were with Conan, and you went with Conan when he goes to LA in, I think this was 2009, to do the Tonight Show.
Yes.
And that ended up lasting for a total of 9 months. Do I have that right?
That's about right. Yeah. It was,
long enough to give birth to another show, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then we did the TBS show on the Warner Brothers lot, which, even though I wish Conan had gotten a full shot at the Tonight Show that we all know he deserved, you know, and I wish he deserved time to build the show into what he wanted, because those shows always have to find themselves, and he deserved a full shot at it, of course. But that said, I always felt like when we went over to TBS, it felt more like late night, in the sense that it was more like we were playing around and just mm-hmm. trying things. The Tonight Show, nothing against its history or anything, but it has a lot of institutional baggage with it. You know, Conan once said the Tonight Show is a little like a big, beautiful ship that moves very slowly, and, you know, it turns very slowly and you can't, mm-hmm. but at the TBS show and at late night, he said it was more like we were in a little cigarette boat that could zip around and go any direction, mm. try things. And if we're not going in the right direction, we can zip over here. And I thought that was a really perfect metaphor for it. So yeah, I wish he'd had a chance to build that show into what we all know he could have, you know, with his genius. That's the thing. He and Stephen are two of the true geniuses I've met in my life. And I'm not just saying that because they're my bosses. They really are. And I know that he could have built that into, he should have been given the time to turn it into a,
yeah, absolutely. I agree. I mean, obviously he did great doing his own thing and he was able to land on his feet. But I mean, how surreal was that when that whole thing was unfolding?
It was pretty bonkers because one of the craziest things is we've found out from TMZ that Leno was going back to 11:30. No one told us.
Wow.
So, and we're like, what? Wait, what? I didn't look at TMZ, you know, but one of the other writers comes by and goes, did you see TMZ? And I was like, I never looked at it. So I was like, oh, wow. So that was pretty insane. But it was very surreal. But I really admire Conan's attitude about the whole thing. He said, you know what? If the show's finishing up, let's go out having the most fun possible. And Stephen did the same thing at the late show. Like, let's just have a great time and do the most fun shows we can possibly do and just make it joyful and just fun. And like Conan's last Tonight Show, you know, Neil Young came out and played Long May You Run, you know, it should just bring a tear to your eye. And he said, after playing his song, he said, thank you for what you've done for new music. Like, he wasn't talking about guys like him.
Yeah.
You know, like the guys who could play any show and go play SNL and play any other big show. But he was talking about up and coming bands that Neil Young was always a champion of, obviously up and coming young indie bands. And like, he helped launch Devo, for God's sake, you know, which is crazy. And the Sex Pistols, and he was always supporting them. And then Will Ferrell came by and did Freebird with him, and Steve Carell did an exit interview. And and same with like Colbert's last show. It was just, as bittersweet as it was more joyful than anything. You know, it was just like, let's go out with the spirit that we want to just give people a joyful experience and give everyone here at the show as joyful an experience as we can.
Absolutely.
Wow. Yeah. And it was a very joyful show with the last Colbert episode. I mean, how did you react when you got the news that the Colbert show was ending? Because that was so out of left field.
I gotta admit, it was a real shock. Partly because, you know, it was the number one show in its time slot. And we knew that the network landscape had changed in a lot of ways and that budget cuts are always possible. And that stuff makes sense to everyone. You know that a lot of the shows have had to make cuts or cut the band or cut some writers or cut some staff members or researchers or whatever. That's just the reality of network TV these days, because viewership isn't what it was when I started. But cancellation was definitely a shock. It didn't really make sense to me anyway. I know we'll never know for sure all the stuff that went into the decision, but I think people can kind of draw their own conclusions, you know, with that, and just think that the only way it makes sense to me is if there were other things other than financial, you know, budgetary reasons.
Yeah. I mean, since you're not an employee of CBS or Paramount anymore, do you want to say anything critical of them? You're not beholden to them.
Well,
let loose.
Well, you know, I grew up, you know, loving CBS, but I do find it sad what's happening at places like 60 Minutes and with what can happen with these big corporate mergers. And the fact that the government can hold up a merger and actually affect the decisions of networks is very troubling to me. And I think it should be troubling to anyone in America that cares about democracy and fairness, because I think personally that, you know, when you have agendas other than just running the network, you know, and I don't pretend to know what all those what people are thinking and what the executives are thinking. But it is sad to me to see like what's happening at 60 Minutes and with guys like Scott Pelley, who I think is very heroic for standing up for the show that he cared about so much. I really admire him for that. And I always admire John Dickerson, and he's no longer with the network. And so I think they've lost some wonderful people along with our show. And yeah, I like to think, you know, things will evolve in a good way down the line. But it's troubling when you see the government get involved with creativity and trying to shut down certain voices, like what they're trying to do with Kimmel too, you know, and just basically trying to silence dissent, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's troubling for sure.
And laughter is also just such a potent weapon against that stuff. I mean, I know, like, you know, not every late night show is overtly political, and some have become more so over the last few years, and maybe just been forced to because of the times we're living in. But yeah, it's scary to think that people are just like, you know, you can't say that about the government or the president or whatever.
Yeah, when you have like a malignant narcissist like Trump, the last thing in the world he wants is to, I think he fears as much as death, like he fears mockery and jokes, like, you know, more than anything. And like, it's why he goes after SNL so much. It's why he goes after Kimmel so much. It's why he went after Stephen so much. He'll go after anyone that dares to hold him accountable or make jokes about him. Like, right. If he could make it, I'm convinced that if he could make it illegal to make jokes about him, he would.
Yeah.
That's my personal belief. And I have no doubt about that in my mind.
Yeah, for sure. I think we might have skipped over one thing. So you were working on Conan, and then you went to Colbert. Like, how did that transition come about?
Well, you know, I always loved working with Conan and never had a desire to leave there because I loved working with them. But I had always hoped to work with Stephen in some way. I'd been one of his biggest fans since the old Chicago days. When I started touring at Second City, he was in the main stage cast with Steve Carell and Amy Sedaris and people like that. And he was in Farley's first touring company. I remember first time I ever saw Stephen was when I went to see Farley's first touring company show at Second City. And he was just always so brilliant. And I think I had always hoped to work with Stephen in some way. And when it was announced that he was taking over for Letterman, my family had also been feeling a real pull back to New York, where my daughters were born and everything. And so I reached out just at the possibility of coming to work with Stephen, which I'd always hoped to do in some way. And Tom Purcell, who was there, and Paul Dinello, these people I loved from Chicago. And they said, you know, if it's okay with Conan, we'd love to have you. They don't poach people. And Conan couldn't have been nicer about it. And it's the only way I would have wanted to do it anyway. He totally understood, you know, that, and he and Stephen are friends, which really helps too. And so they were both incredibly classy and great about it. And, but yeah, it was never a question of like wanting to leave Conan. It was more like a question of hoping to work with Stephen in some way and hoping I could contribute in some way to this new show he was doing. To be honest, when I would watch the Colbert Report, I thought it was brilliant, but I was like, oh, wow, I don't know how they do that. Like, I'm not a political comedian, really. Yeah, I've never been a real – political satire is my natural strong suit. So, but I always admired it so much. And so I've tried to contribute in my own way to The Late Show, but I work with people like Stephen who are just geniuses of political satire, and I learned so much from them just watching how they – can rip jokes off of what seemingly dry data points from the news.
Yeah. And a similarity I've noticed between Conan and Stephen is they both have a healthy appreciation for absurdity and surreal stuff. So there is that commonality between them. But what was it difficult to adjust to writing for somebody else's voice? Because you'd written for Conan for 18 years, and suddenly you have to shift over and you're writing for Stephen's voice. Was there anything you were like, oh no, that's a Conan joke, I can't do that on here?
To be honest, like that, like you mentioned, and I think that was a really insightful comment. They both love smart stupidity and stupid smartness, and they both love silly stuff. The big difference was that Stephen's show is much more monologue centric, so the monologue was much more of a big chunk of the show, and there were several jokes on each story and things like that. At Conan, like, I didn't even work on the monologue. We had some, except that, like, when he did the award shows, we all sort of worked on the monologues then. But I just worked on sketch bits and desk bits that he would do at the desk and things like that, and character bits, and sometimes things that he would do with the guests and stuff. But the nature of the material was much more topical at Stephen's show, and the and monologue centric. But other than that, like, in terms of the kind of guys they are, they love being silly. They love stuff that isn't about politics too. Like, Stephen loved doing stuff about, like, our Meanwhile segments were stuff that had nothing to do with politics or the headlines of the day. It was usually like, you know, a drunk raccoon running through a liquor store or something, you know.
Right.
And we all loved writing that. And Stephen loved doing those stories because it was such an escape from the day-to-day, you know, hammering of the news. And so it, personality-wise, in terms of what they really like, I think their senses of humor are very similar. Like, they love smart silliness. They both are, like, huge fans of a lot of the same comedians, the SCTV people and Peter Sellers. And, you know, and of course, we all grew up, you know, loving Letterman and his anti-talk show kind of irony. And all that stuff. So I think a lot of the influences were the same. And I think a lot of there's a lot similar in their senses of humor, but it was more about the kind of material we did on a nightly basis that would just tended to be more topical at Stephen's show.
And typically, like, if you're working on a certain aspect of the show or certain characters, you have ownership of that. Like, if you're I'm going to reach back to Conan because it's just the handiest thing. Like, for like one of your regular recurring characters, like Artie Kendall or Hannigan, you would always have a hand in writing that. It wouldn't be like anybody on the staff would write that. Like, oh, hey, I wrote an Artie Kendall this week. I mean, you would always have a hand in that, right?
Yeah. Some were very collaborative. Artie Kendall, I did. I wrote all those by myself, but they were very formulaic, as you know. They were always the same basic things.
The racist joke, the sexist joke, and then the Irish joke.
Exactly. And so it followed kind of a little bit of a formula, as you could tell. And then I started kind of ad-libbing those little extra things like ploppity drum, you know, at the end of the song. That were just because it felt like it needed something extra after the songs. But those were usually just tossed in to see if I could throw Conan off. But then some of the other sketches were very collaborative. Like, I would write the Hannigan sketches with Michael Coman and Andrew Weinberg. And I wrote Interrupter a lot with Michael Coman, who's a wonderful writer and wrote at SNL too himself. And is currently doing that show, The Paper, that's sort of from the same under the Office umbrella, you know, sort of feel. It was very collaborative. I wrote a lot with Brian McCann. I wrote a lot with John Glazer. I wrote a lot with all the writers over the years, actually. Tommy Blacha. We would bounce around ideas with Andy Richter a lot. Andy was another old improv friend of ours from Chicago. That's who I knew Andy from the Improv Olympic days.
Mm-hmm.
It was always very collaborative, very much like working at Second City, actually. It was very much of an ensemble. A lot of our best stuff came not from sitting at your computer, but from bouncing ideas around and riffing off of each other.
And you mentioned, like, the improv quality. A character you did on the Conan TBS days that seemed to have a fair amount of improv baked into it was Wiki Bear. He's like this little Teddy Ruxpin type talking bear, and he's giving like Wikipedia trivia, but with like a lot of his characters, it has this dark undercurrent, and he would just like always pivot over to like serial killers and things like that.
Yeah, that was very fun to do. And that was another thing that kind of evolved accidentally. Originally, Todd Levin and I wrote those bits together. And when we started, it was kind of based on the idea that Wikipedia often has incorrect information. you know, a lot of it's fine, but there's stuff in there where you're like, wait a minute, you know? And so it started off where one of the stories was, maybe it was about the Donner Party, I think, where they turned to cannibalism, and it was a little dark. And Conan joked at rehearsal, hey, Wiki Bear, why don't you just talk about the Manson family? You know, just like joke. And I know way too much about the Manson family. So I just started riffing about details about the Manson.
So all that was just off the dome? You didn't have
a lot of that was, and Conan knows everything about that too. So he starts riffing back and forth about like Vincent Pugliosi, you know, who wrote the book, and Abigail Folger, you know, and all these people. So we were just riffing about and Tex Watkins so it evolved, and then so we started riffing, and everyone was really enjoying it going dark with this cute little bear going so dark, and Conan was like, I think this is the bit. I think he's talking about very dark things, but in his Wiki Bear sweet voice. And I'm Wiki Bear, yay. And then it started getting really, really dark, like with like, what kind of God would allow that to happen? You know, and stuff like that. And but that was another one that I've often been surprised over the years how much people have enjoyed, because it's like that was another one that was, well, let's try this, and you never know. And so that was really, it's nice to see that people have enjoyed Wiki Bear, because that was another one where we had no idea the first time that if it was going to be anything.
Yeah. And it really worked. And part of what made that so effective was just the sort of the interplay and the sense of play between you and Conan. I think you were obviously enjoying riffing with each other.
It was really fun. I remember one time he like knocked me off the desk.
Yeah.
Like just swatted the bear. And I was like, you know, it was fun to play with that. I was like, and one time I actually stepped on his line and I go, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Please go on. You know, and it would just be, or one time I dropped the paper.
And were you working the mouth like with a remote?
No. I was in the voiceover booth, and this brilliant special effects guy, Eric Allard, built Wiki Bear, and he actually built the Energizer Bunny for commercials. And he did Johnny Five in the Short Circuit movies. And we were just blessed to have Eric there, because Eric, I think he took like kind of a Build-A-Bear and he put like a little mechanized thing in there, and he worked it with a little joystick, and he would try to follow along with what I was saying. I have Eric to thank for kind of controlling him. But I was just in the booth, and one time I sort of started dropping the papers on some of the papers started falling off the easel, and my dialogue got interrupted, and Conan's just like, what's going on in there? You know, those were a lot of times our favorite moments. Steven too, being an improviser, he loves when things go off the rails.
Yeah.
And those are a lot of times our favorite moments when you can play with, because the audience knows something went wrong, and if you have fun with it, they love it.
Yeah. I mean, and those are the moments that you remember, is the moments where something goes wrong in some way, like the Ed Ames tomahawk bit on the Tonight Show. I mean, because how do you can't plan something like that.
You can't. Or the first Debbie Downer, when I think there was if I remember right, the trombone note was a little bit different than they expected or something. Yeah. And it broke Rachel, or they all started breaking up, but it was very genuine. And the breaking was very genuine, and it was just pure joy to watch them lose it like that. Cause if that happened all the time, you'd be like, oh, come on. But when it's that real and it's organic and it's just happening in the moment, there's nothing better, you know?
Yeah, it isn't true. And like another that you did, it was sort of almost a revival of one of your Conan characters. You came on as Frankenstein this last Halloween on the Colbert show.
Yeah.
To do the Colbert questionnaire in character as Frankenstein, which, and the makeup was so similar to how you looked on Conan. I think I actually wrote you after that bit aired, and I was like, did you hear from Conan about that?
Oh yeah, that was a very strange thing, because Gabe Gronley and Aaron Cohen, who had actually been interns for us at Conan years ago, are writer producers on the Colbert show. And, when it was around Halloween, I was doing Frankenstein. They had me dress up as Frankenstein for a commercial parody with Guillermo del Toro and Steven, where it was Frankenstein, like monster. It was Monster Energy Drink, but it was like Frankenstein's Monster Energy Drink. And it was Guillermo del Toro, the director, in the commercial. And I was just kind of going, you know, in that, in the commercial. But Gabe, I think, said, what if we had Brian do the Colbert questionnaire as Frankenstein, just mm-hmm. as a web bonus thing. And so I said, well, should I do it as Frankenstein, as answer as Frankenstein would, or should I answer more as Brian? And at rehearsal, I just kind of, they said, why don't you just try saying your own voice?
Yeah.
Come out as Frankenstein, but then just answer as Brian. And I was like, and so that got a really nice response at rehearsal. So we just decided to go with me kind of going, coming out going,
yeah.
And like, well, what's the best sandwich? And I was like, probably a BLT. You know,
and you just switched to your natural speaking voice, and I lost it when I first saw it because it was just so funny, so unexpected. And I mean, were you improvising your answers on that, or did Stephen know what was coming generally?
He didn't know what my answers were going to be, and I think some of them were kind of off the cuff. Some I had in mind because I was trying to think. Some were a mix of. Some were based on what Frankenstein would say, like, you know, I'm made out of mm-hmm. dead people and stuff like that. But some of them I was like, well, what would I say for first concert?
Yeah.
I guess Frankenstein would have probably said, you know, Mozart or something like that. But I just said The Honest Truth, which was Van Halen with David Lee Roth, which was my first concert. And so I did, some of them were just real things from my life. And he said, what's your favorite, what song would you want to hear for the rest of your life? And I just said, Van Morrison's Astral Weeks, mm-hmm. which, and really, it was just an honest answer, but I kind of panicked because I was like, oh, that's too straight an answer. So I threw in I said, but if you want to go with classical music, it'd be like Queen's Fat Bottom Girls, you know? And like,
right.
So I just thought I should throw in something that was more of a joke. And Fat Bottom Girls is a very fun song, but, yeah, it was not one I had planned on mentioning.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, did the atmosphere of the show change when you knew the end was coming in the last few months or the last few weeks? I mean, you talked about how Stephen wanted to make it as joyful as possible.
I think we all appreciated each other. I mean, we always appreciate each other. The staffs, I got to say, and as corny as it might sound, the staffs at Conan and at Colbert, from the band to the crew, to the lighting guys, to the audio guys, to the talent bookers, it really felt like a family, you know. It was a mm-hmm. wonderful bunch of people. And that tone gets set from the top. People like Stephen and Conan set this tone of, and I noticed that, like, I did a little bit part at Parks and Rec and shows like that are at The Office. And they set the tone from the top too. It's like people like Carell and Amy set such a lovely tone of family on the set where everybody's professional and wants to do a great job, but it's so respectful and kind, you know, on the set. And our office. So I think it made me appreciate everyone even more because I knew it was going to come to an end. And so I'm grateful it wasn't a sudden end, like where they just said, you're off the air tomorrow. So as sad as it was to have it come to an end, we got to have about 10 months where we could enjoy each other and enjoy that time. And so it was bittersweet, but I'm honestly more grateful than sad, but you know, it's sad. I miss everybody. And we had a writer's dinner the other night at one of the writer's houses with, you know, with Stephen. It was just wonderful. You know, and I miss everybody a lot. It's only been a couple of weeks, but it's hard. You know, I've had a lot of jobs that weren't hard to leave. And, you know, this one and Conan were hard to leave, you know, cause I love the people.
And it's so wild to me that you've been through two of the strangest cancellation stories in late night between the Conan Tonight Show fiasco and the whole Colbert cancellation thing. Those are both wild, and you were there for both of them. Does that give you an interesting perspective on the whole late night business, about how it could all just go away at a moment's notice or with several months' notice?
Yeah, it can. And you realize that there were obviously totally different factors involved, but it's a strange thing because you realize, first of all, I think when the shows, like I'd worked at Conan for so many years at that point, and like the guys who were at late night in the early days, they thought they were getting canceled every week. You know, they were like, they'd be like on a Friday once, like in the early days. I came in when things were much more stable and Conan was number one in his time slot. And I started in 97, a few years into the show, and it felt, you know, it never felt like that level of stressful. It just felt, you know, you never knew what you were going to do the next day. So you were stressed out about filling the show, but you weren't worried about getting canceled every day. And early on, I think they were like, I don't know if they're going to keep us on the air, you know? And so the stability was something I got, I wouldn't say I took it for granted, but I was very grateful for the stability of working so many years at one place. So even when those cancellations have happened, like at the Tonight Show and at Stephen Show, the fact that we got to do it for so many years, you know, I'll always be grateful for that.
Yeah, I mean, and you had such a great career. I mean, you were nominated for writing Emmys for like over 20 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, it was. I'm very grateful for that, and it was always nice when your peers, you know, think you're doing a good job, and like a lot of times with award shows, you know, a lot of your favorite shows don't even get nominated, or the things you love most, or like The Wire, I don't think ever won an Emmy, you know.
Mm-hmm. So it's insane.
Like Better Call Saul didn't win any Emmys, I know.
Yeah, that's bananas. Steve Carell never won an Emmy for The Office. I mean, what more do you need to realize that there's a lot of insane things about it? So I never took it as like a super seriously, you know, or mm-hmm. thought that it was an indication of what's genuinely. I think a lot of times deserving shows and people win, and sometimes they don't. And, but that's just, we know that that's how it works at all the award shows, Grammys, the Oscars. Yeah. But it's lovely when, now and then you're like, yes. Like when Jeff Hiller won the Emmy for Somebody Somewhere last year, I've done a lot of improv shows with Jeff and I was like, yes, you know, there's like, it was such a nice,
Were you there or were you watching at home?
I was watching at home for that one. And, I was just so happy for him and, cause I think he's just always been kind of this gem that seemed like he should have been more recognized. And, so now and then it's, it's lovely to see things like that.
Well, we should take a minute to brag on your behalf, because you've been nominated for Emmys every year from 98 through 2011. And that was with various iterations of Conan Show. And then from 2017 through 2023, this is according to the Television Academy website. So that's 23 total nominations, one win in 2007 for Conan Show. And that's pretty amazing.
Oh, thanks
just
so much.
Longevity, man.
I'm very, very grateful that we got all those nominations. And I don't know if I'm mentioned to you, but like the one night we won the Emmy for Conan, I wasn't actually there at the Emmys. I was doing an improv show at UCB, the ASCAT show. And, cause we always lost, you know, and we were going to have to work that Monday. And, we didn't want to take the red eye flight. So only like five of the writers were there with Conan when they won. And it was a very nice surprise. My dad texted my wife, Miriam, we were doing the show at UCB and he said, "Hey, you guys won." And I was like, "No," but that was a really wonderful surprise. And I certainly wasn't expecting it, but we were always happy to get nominated. And that was, as corny as that sounds, it was really true. It was always fun to go out and see some friends in LA and things like that.
Where do you keep your Emmy?
Oh, we have it in the living room, just on one of the bookshelves, which is nice. And it was a nice souvenir of all those years at Conan. It was, I'm very grateful for that. It was a nice surprise.
That's very cool.
Thanks.
And well, I mean, so you're a free agent again after a number of years. What's next to you? Do you know where you're going to land next? Or are you just going to have fun bouncing around for a while?
You know, I'm not sure exactly, John. I'd like to try writing some. So I'd like to, the idea of the challenge of trying to write something that is more in the narrative form. Like I've been such a creature of late night for 29 years and mostly a sketch person, even in my Chicago days, writing, sketches at Second City and things like that. So the idea of writing, trying to write maybe like a longer form thing, whether it's a, maybe even a more dramatic thing. Mm-hmm. I enjoy the idea of trying to do something different. I love doing voiceover work. Like I'd love to do more of that. I used to do a ton of that, years ago, and I've done a lot of it at Conan and Colbert over the years. Just like,
You were like voice of cartoon Donald Trump, I believe.
Early on. Yeah. That was kind of because they were kind of stuck. And then, I didn't really do Trump. I sort of did like the attitude of Trump more than anything. they would have me do like anytime there was an old president, like I'd be doing FDR or Winston Churchill or John F. Kennedy or, you know, those kind of things. Fake commercial announcers and things like that for Colbert. And I've always loved doing that, but I've loved doing animation stuff. I haven't done much in recent years, but like I did like a airline pilot in the movie Hotel Transylvania and things like that. And I'd love to do more like that. Was thanks to Robert Smigel calling me in on that. Actually, he was nice enough to do that. And I love doing animation stuff. I just did a podcast for a hilarious guy named Mike Sachs called Stanland, he had me do a Irish leprechaun. Well, Irish, that's redundant. But that was really fun. And that was a really amazing cast. I wish I could have worked with them. I just did my voice by myself remotely, but Rhea Seehorn from Better Call Saul is in that.
She's amazing.
Yeah, she's wonderful. And Bobby Moynihan, Bobby and-
Never heard of him.
Yeah. Bobby and Rhea Seehorn were the two of the main characters, but they had guests. Mike also got like John Hamm and John Waters and all these amazing people. I wish I could have met them. I never got to meet. I know Bobby from years ago. He did bits for us at Conan, but I've never met Rhea Seehorn or, you know, John Waters or anything, but I'd love to. But so it's really fun to do that kind of thing. I think I'll enjoy doing voiceover work as much as I like anything. You know, I like the kind of anonymity of it, and you're just in a booth. I always feel comfortable in a voiceover booth.
Do you have a home studio or anything?
I have during COVID, they sent me some stuff for home stuff, like a green screen. I used to do some cold open shoots here, and I have like a basic home setup, not a full booth, but it worked for the show, and it's worked for things like the leprechaun thing and stuff. But I thought about getting more of a real booth if I end up doing more stuff again. But I'd love to try writing some stuff. I still do some improv now and then, like once a month down at UCB, I'll jump in with some old friends and do this show called Gravid Water, which is really, really fun. And we get some SNL people that jump in for that, like Rachel Dratch and Jason Sudeikis. And that's always really fun, where they pair up an actor with an improviser and the actors have memorized lines from a play and they have to do the lines in order and the improviser don't know what the play is.
So
it's really, really fun.
They used to do a bit like that on the British Who's Line. I mean, they had the other actor reading from the script, but I remember seeing that on Who's Line Is It Anyway on Comedy Central in the 90s.
Yeah, we did a bit called Playbook in Chicago where you'd hold the playbook and you get a page number or something.
Right.
This Gravid Water is really interesting because Stephen Ruddy, who produces the show, gets these amazing stage and film actors who give a full dramatic performance, like they're in a play, and the improviser just has to react to it. Like,
wow.
But I've done scenes where people were crying, like with tears coming down their face. And I just want to stop the scene and go, isn't this amazing?
Look at this.
Yeah, that was.
He's really acting his heart out there.
Yeah, that was Jennifer Carpenter, who I don't know if you ever saw the show Dexter, but she played the sister.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
This was in L.A. at the UCB show, but she had tears going down her face. And I know she's like Juilliard trained and everything, but I'm just so fascinated by that kind of acting talent where people can do those things. Like when people can cry on cue like that, it's just amazing. Yeah. So, I'd love to just explore trying some different things and if that's my last staff job in late night, I'm grateful to have done it for 29 years. I'd be open to doing more, but I know the landscape for late night TV has changed a lot, as you know. But I'd love to do. I've always felt comfortable in that world, and I'm not expecting to do another late night show, but I do I love that world, and I love the people there, and I love the ensemble nature of it. So yeah, we'll see. It's kind of open-ended right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, it's got to be kind of exciting, and I'm sure there's a little nervousness in there too, because it's just, you're in unknown territory.
Yeah, but. Yeah, it's a little of both, really. It's like grateful for what I've gotten to do, you know, looking forward to trying something else. And I'd love to try some things I've never tried before, like writing, like I said, different kinds of formats and more narrative things. And like, I love how things can kind of come back around years later too. Like one of our old Conan interns that we always loved, Katie Dippold, created this new show, Widow's Bay, that is on Apple, and it's getting all this wonderful attention, very deservedly. It's a brilliant show, but she had written that like 20 years ago. Like, wow. She wrote the pilot like 20 years ago, and I think it helped get her hired at Parks and Recreation as a writer, because it was such a good script, and Katie's so funny and smart. But it's funny how things can kind of just incubate for a while, and sometimes you never know when it's going to find its time. And she got a lot of opportunities from that script. But I remember hearing that Matthew Weiner, his Mad Men script, got him hired at The Sopranos, but he never thought it was going to get made. Like, he didn't think Mad Men was going to get made. And that obviously turned into a great show of its own. But a lot of times, you know, if you just write something that comes from the heart and comes from your what you think is good, it may not get made for a while, or may never get made, but maybe someone will respond to it and just like the way you think, you know, or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. Wow.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I guess that's it. I mean, thanks so much for doing the podcast, Brian. This is fantastic.
This has been amazing. I mean, you've been around for so much. I don't want to say comedy history, but I mean.
No. It was, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much, guys. I really enjoyed talking to you, and I appreciate your interest in stuff I've done, and it means a lot. So thank you for asking me to do it.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for allowing us to waste well over a minute of your time. So.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. It was fun to talk to you guys. So thanks.
Thank you. And that's our episode, guys. Thanks for listening to the podcast. As always, you can follow us on the Blue Sky at SNL Nerds. Then you can listen to this on our YouTube page, non-productive.com. You can donate to our Patreon. And you could follow me, myself, and I on all the socials at Darren Credible, D-A-R-I-N Credible.
And you can follow me on the socials at Trumbull Comic. That's T-R-U-M-B-U-L-L and the word comic. Brian, where can people find you?
Oh, well, these days I'm on Instagram. I'm on Blue Sky and Threads a little bit, too. Hmm. Yeah, I'm on X technically, but I haven't been posting on there lately because.
Oh, really? Did something happen with X?
I'm not totally deactivated or anything, but I'll check like in on college sports stuff and stuff on there, but just see what's big stories are floating around. But I don't tend to post on there anymore.
Yeah, but you can. I'm looking at your Blue Sky profile right now. You're Brian Stack 153 at Blue Sky. So yeah, check him out there.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah,
he's a great follow.
Well, thank you very much. So. And I really appreciate it, guys. And all the best.
Yeah, thank you so much. So I think that's it for this week. We're going to be back again with something else. We're not sure quite yet. I mean, this is going to be a tough one to top, though.
Thank you.
we've peaked.
This is the highlight, yes.
This is the highlight, yeah.
Nowhere else to go but down from here.
Exactly. So you know, so be back for our next week, where it'll be a much less interesting episode. Until then, nerds out.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.